Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast. I'm Zachary Elwood. On today's podcast, recorded January 8th, 2021, I talked to Daniel Whiteson, who is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of California, Irvine. Our subject is free will. Daniel and I talk a little bit about why we both think that free will is unlikely to exist, but our main focus is on more psychological and emotional aspects. Basically, what are the results in our own lives of not believing in free will? Because the idea that free will doesn't exist can be an anxiety or sadness-producing idea. The idea that we're basically just automatons, that our conscious experience of the world is like watching a movie we have no real control over. When it comes to learning arguments for or against free will, there are plenty of better resources on these things from more informed philosophers than Daniel and I. So that's why I wanted to focus on something he and I were able to talk about, how such ideas impact us personally. A little bit about Daniel Whiteson. He's the author of a book called We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe, which he co-wrote with Jorge Cham. That book examines the unanswered questions of the universe. I enjoyed the book a lot, especially because when it comes to some physics writing and research, you can get the sense that some physicists are arrogant, that they think they have the universe figured out. Not to say all physicists believe that, but that can be the sense one gets from their writing and speaking about it. So I really enjoyed Whiteson's book for the focus on the mysteries of the universe, of which there are many. His decision to focus on the many unanswered questions about our world, his humility about the mysteries of the world, was one reason I thought he'd make an interesting person to talk to about this subject. And because I thought it'd be interesting to hear what a physicist, with their necessary focus on the physicality of our existence, thinks about these topics. You can follow Daniel on Twitter at Daniel Whiteson. His last name is spelled W-H-I-T-E-S-O-N. And he has his own physics podcast called Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe. If you're curious to learn more about free will, you can check out my blog at readingpokertells.video. For the post about this episode, I've included some resources that have influenced my thinking or that we mentioned in this episode. I also want to thank Christopher Moyer, a psychology researcher and professor who you may remember I talked to in a previous episode about electrodermal activity. Moyer was very helpful in talking to me about free will and helped me arrive at some interesting areas of discussion. You can follow Moyer on Twitter at Moyer Psychology. Intro music is by Small Skies. Okay, here's the interview with Daniel Whiteson. All right, thanks for coming on, Daniel.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's an honor to have you on. I thought we'd start out with some quick thoughts about why we believe what we believe about free will, and then we'll get into thoughts about how those kinds of beliefs affect our life. Let's start out with, if you had to sum up your beliefs about the likelihood of free will in a few sentences, what would you say?
Well, you know, I'm a physicist, and I'm the kind of physicist that likes to take a reductionist view of the universe, meaning I want to take complex things apart and understand them in terms of their simpler bits and see things as like emergent phenomena from the rules that apply to very small pieces. And so I like to take things apart and understand that they follow rules. So from my point of view, everything in the universe so far follows some rules. Maybe they're chaotic, maybe there's random elements to them, but there are always rules there. So it's hard for me to imagine any place in our system of natural laws for something as fuzzy and hard to describe as like a freedom of choice, you know, where there's this like supernatural element where somebody gets to flip a switch. So I don't have a complete understanding of the nature of the human experience or how people make decisions. And I certainly don't have a good grasp on how to define morality from a philosophical point of view, but I don't see any room for free will in our universe.
Maybe it's a good thing to start out with. Let's define what we mean when we say free will. So one definition I read that I thought was pretty good was the freedom of humans to make choices that are not determined by prior causes. And I'm curious if that seems like a pretty good definition to you.
Yeah, I think it does, because you want to get down to the heart of the matter, which is like, am I making these decisions? Meaning I'm in a certain moment, could I have made a different choice than the one I've made, right? This is the freedom to make another choice. And if your choices are determined by the things that happened before, or even if the probability of your choices is determined quantum mechanically by things that happened before, then you're not really influencing. You're just sort of along for the ride. So yeah, I think that's a great description of what we mean by free will.
Right. It seems like so much of the writing and talking about free will, even from academics and philosophers, a lot of it just seems so abstract and overly complicated to me, when to me, you know, my belief that free will is very unlikely is based on, like you said, it's a very simple idea that, you know, if you believe that the world is a physical place, that our minds, our brains are physical objects and they follow physical laws, then it's a pretty simple idea that everything that we experience is just based on particles, reactions happening in our brains, you know, our brains interacting with the world, et cetera, et cetera. Barring some unforeseen law or rules, which, you know, I don't rule out, I'm open-minded about those things, but barring some unforeseen property happening, these are all physical reactions. And I feel like a lot of the talking about it gets overly complicated, but that's what it boils down to for me.
Yeah, but even if you found some new law, right, then that would just be another law that describes how things happen. What you really need for free will is some sort of like supernatural, some sort of like extra law thing, something which doesn't follow from the past. And, you know, it's not that like we've described the entire universe in terms of physical laws, and so we can say there's nothing out there that can't be described by physical laws. But so far, it's a pretty successful strategy, you know, doing experiments, trying to deduce physical laws, using those to predict the future. It works, you know, we can predict exactly how a cannonball will fly. Like, physics does predict the future. That's the game we're in. When we smash particles together at the Large Hadron Collider, we have a pretty good sense for what's going to happen. And there's a lot, I think, of fuzziness involved in two areas. One is chaos and the other is randomness, where people sort of like try to stuff free will in there because there's a, you know, room there for fuzziness. But I think, you know, maybe we should go through that, but I don't really think there's any room for free will there. And then there's the other gap, which is like, yeah, we don't really understand everything about the human experience. Like, some of these things might be emergent phenomena from smaller, you know, from particles following rules that we can make sense of, but we can't always connect the dots, right? We don't even understand like how hurricanes form, right? You know, we understand how water droplets move and we can do some calculations, but we don't have the computers that can do the calculations that can predict, is the hurricane going to hit Alabama or not, right? We have to ask President Trump that question. That doesn't mean that they don't follow physical laws. It just means that, like, we don't always understand them. But whenever there's a gap there, people like to insert, you know, oh, maybe that's where human consciousness is, or maybe that's where free will is, or God is, or something.
It's a hope, yeah. It's like, maybe that unpredictability is a place where our magical ability to have free will might reside. But it would almost, to me, take, yeah, like a supernatural element to give us free will, because barring that, to me, it's like the choices between us being in a physical world following physical laws that make sense, or some supernatural ability that gives us the ability to transcend that. And to me, that just seems a clear-cut divide. And I'm pretty sure it's one way, but at the same time, I find the universe so mysterious and reality and consciousness so mysterious and amazing that I don't rule out anything, but I know what I think is more likely.
Yeah. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, right? To acknowledge the assumptions that we're making along the way. Like, it's a pretty big assumption that the universe follows physical laws. Like, that's not based on anything. That's just like, well, let's assume that and see how well it works. Oh, it works really well, you know, or the assumption that empiricism works, that you can do an experiment and from it deduce a rule, which is also relevant later, right? That the physical laws aren't just changing. We don't know why that's the case. It seems to be, but so far it seems to work. And so, you know, we should acknowledge that those assumptions are at the foundation of the whole scientific practice. And we don't necessarily know that they are true philosophically, but they seem to work and it seems to be successful. And so I think, you know, because we've defined free will in this way to be a choice that's not dependent on causes, we've also sort of pinned it in the corner there, requiring it to be supernatural, because if it was dependent on the causes, it would just be another physical law. You know, you can ask yourself the question, like, could we ever prove that? You know, could we ever do an experiment where we demonstrate that somebody made a choice that wasn't determined by the previous situations or not? Or is it just a pure philosophical question? Or could it actually be a scientific question?
The word that I like that appeals to me is when I think about these things is the universe and our minds and our experiences. All of it is an unfolding. And I like that word unfolding because it, to me, captures kind of the beauty, like a flower unfolding. And, mm-hmm. you know, it can be a complex, mysterious experience, but it is just something that's being driven by things that happened before it. But it's mm-hmm. still an amazing thing.
It is amazing and it's beautiful and it's fun to watch it unfold. But maybe for your listeners, we should go through it for a moment. Why, for example, the random element of quantum mechanics doesn't allow for a supernatural element of free will? Because I think there are a lot of even physicists out there, you know, that suggest that like quantum mechanics is the heart of consciousness or the place where free will can reside. And I think it's important to maybe clear that up.
Yeah, if you could give a few sentences for that, that'd be great. And then we'll get into kind of the more psychological and emotional stuff.
So the thing to understand about quantum mechanics is that it's not that like all the rules are out the window, that there's no causality, right? Quantum mechanics has rules. It has very firm rules about what can happen, but those rules are probabilistic. Like they don't say what will happen when you do an experiment, like you smash two particles together. They don't say this is exactly what will happen. They say what's more likely to happen and what's less likely to happen. And those probabilities are directly determined by how you set up the experiment. You set it up differently, you're going to get different probabilities. We can do those calculations, and those are very firm laws of physics. So quantum mechanics doesn't like upend the laws of physics and say there is no causality, there is no determinism. It just takes it a step up to sort of the meta level and says the exact outcome isn't determined, the probability of various outcomes is determined. And how you pick among those, we believe, is truly random. And we have experiments that are sort of mind-boggling that show you that there really is a random element in the universe. And so that doesn't allow for free will. It's not like the quantum mechanics says, well, it's either A or B, you pick. There's no knob there where you get to sort of like flip a switch or press a button and decide between them. Mm-hmm. So quantum mechanics doesn't allow for, you know, violations of causality. It just says that the specific outcomes has a random element.
Like you said, it's just a place where people place their hopes where free will could live because there is unpredictability there. It doesn't do anything in itself to, other than giving some unexplained territory, it doesn't help the argument of free will.
Exactly. It's a fuzzy place where people can sort of, you know, slap two fuzzy things together and say, hey, maybe these two things are related. And, you know, there are things about quantum mechanics we don't understand. Like, how does that collapse happen when you have two probabilities and then you do an experiment and the universe chooses A or B? How does it make that choice? How does the actual random number generator of the universe work? When does that collapse happen? These are deep, unanswered questions about the nature of quantum mechanics, but they don't need free will or consciousness, we think, to answer them.
And then you've got the many worlds kind of theories of, you know, that explain quantum effects, which would be everything that could happen does happen in some parallel world. In that case, if our choices are quantumly affected in some way, that would mean that every potential choice or action that we could take exists in the many worlds scenario.
Yeah, and that's sort of mind-blowing to imagine that every time there's a quantum mechanical split that like a whole other universe branch is created that follows those other splits. But to me, it doesn't really answer that question. You know, the question mm-hmm. is, why are we on this branch and not the other branches?
Right, it has nothing to do with free will.
It doesn't answer the free will question. It also doesn't answer, in my mind, the deeper quantum mechanical question of why are we on this branch and not the other ones? Like, to say, okay, the other ones also exist doesn't answer the question, why are we experiencing this one? Because we're only experiencing one of them and not the other ones. But anyway, that's a whole digression into the many worlds hypothesis.
Let's talk now about impacts on our lives from these kind of beliefs, because there's a lot of there is a lot of emotion and even anger around these kind of topics. Mm-hmm. It's a touchy subject because many people are depressed and threatened at the idea that there is no free will. The feeling is that the fear is, the anxiety is that we're just automatons going through life with no real choice of our own. And it triggers some of our core existential fears, you know, that our lives are meaningless, that nothing mm-hmm. matters. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you agree that that's why, in a nutshell, that's why that idea is threatening to people.
I'm not sure I can understand why that idea is threatening to people. It's not threatening to me. I mean, I think it's fascinating to try to understand the internal mechanism, how you make decisions, what influences you, what's going on in your head. For me, it doesn't change the experience of being who I am. You know, I still decided to have that pizza, or I didn't decide to have that pizza. Whether or not there was a supernatural moment when I decided pizza versus, you know, salad, or whether that was always going to happen because of what happened earlier that day, because of what happened earlier that year, all the way back to the Big Bang, doesn't bother me. You know, it doesn't change the experience of who I am. So
you still have desires. In other words, you still have desires and you're still trying to avoid suffering and you still have goals, in other words. And the fact that you can see that as completely predetermined doesn't change the fact that in this moment in your life, you have desires, you have sympathy, you have emotions, mm-hmm. et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera.
And I still feel joy. You know, I get to experience that pizza, even if I'm not the one who actually chose it. But maybe it's different because I don't have, you know, frankly, I don't have like things I massively regret in my life. So I'm not constantly battled by demons where I'm wondering like, was this my fault or was that my fault? You know, for people who've had like a terrible accident where maybe they've lost a child due to drowning because they looked the other way and then they wonder like, is that their fault or was it, could they be released from the sort of moral responsibility by being convinced that they are just an automaton and all of this was predetermined? That I can understand that would be much more of a struggle for folks. But, you know, if it's just pizza versus salad, the sort of moral stakes are pretty low.
Well, yeah, and I want to get back to that idea because there's this, you can actually see the downsides of both extreme views. It's like you said, if you actually believe that you were fully responsible and completely had free will, that can be a tremendous burden and fear. You know, I would argue that too, on the opposite end of the no free will spectrum, that can create its own set of fears and anxieties mm-hmm. and guilt, mm-hmm. et cetera. It's not like either one relieves you of existential anxiety of various sorts.
Yeah, but I think it's really fascinating to think about how science reveals the nature of reality, and that changes the way we feel about ourselves and our relationship to the cosmos, because this has been happening for thousands of years, right? Like, science has revealed that we are not the center of the cosmos, nor are we even at the center of our solar system. And that the universe is much, much older than we imagined. And that changes how we feel about like sort of our place in the universe and the importance or lack of importance of our lives. And so it's not an unusual thing for science to reveal a truth which changes how we feel about ourselves and how we live our lives. And I think there are future discoveries like that ahead of us, you know, like say we learn, for example, exactly how the universe was created, like the actual true factual history of the first moments of the universe, and it was indisputable. That would change how a lot of people feel about their lives, you know, like, oh, it turns out there is a God or there isn't a God, or there was a need for some being to create the universe, or it wasn't. We have an explanation for how the universe can come out of nothing. That, I think, would change how people feel about their lives and would live them and make their choices. So I think there's a long history there for science revealing the truth about the universe, changing how we feel about our universe and our choices in it. So we should be prepared for the same kind of thing to happen sort of neurobiologically. If we drill down into the mechanisms of the workings of the human brain, and one day, for example, you could upload your brain and a computer could predict your choices and your speech, that would change the way you felt about who you are and if you ever even really exist as a person.
I'm curious with your work, because I know you had a podcast about free will and that involved you talking to students on the campus you're at, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if in the various conversations you've had, have you had that sense of the idea of lack of free will being threatening to people and seen it arouse anxiety or even anger in people?
I've never seen any anger. Most people, when I talk to them about it, they just sort of dismiss it. They're like, of course I have free will. Mm-hmm. I'm experiencing it right now. I'm choosing this. I'm choosing that. And so I think for most people, there's this feeling like there's an immediacy of free will. Like they know it because they feel it. And so it's sort of like a silly curiosity to imagine you could ever prove free will doesn't exist. So I don't think people take it very seriously.
the other related fear around these ideas is that belief in these ideas, belief in that free will is unlikely, would cause people to behave badly. It would make us not able to punish people for behaving badly. But we still need laws and we still need punishments. Me believing that someone is not responsible at a core level doesn't mean that I don't think we should punish those people. You know, we still have a society that we believe should behave certain ways. And punishment is about making that behavior less likely. It's not about like saying you are responsible and you deserve punishment. It's about discouraging people from behaving a certain way. But I think a lot of the fears around these kind of ideas are related to, oh, well, we'll no longer be able to tell people that they're responsible and we won't be able to legally punish them, you know. And one, there's a book by Derek Paraboom, who's a philosopher, and he wrote a book called Living Without Free Will. And it was about these, you know, how we can still have coherent ethics and punishments even without believing in free will. And that's an interesting book. I didn't read the whole thing, but I skimmed it. And one Amazon review for his book said, "The idea that humans have no free will and are therefore not morally responsible for their actions is not just wrong in an intellectual sense. It is extremely dangerous." And I think that kind of summed up a lot of people's feelings around these things, you know. And so I'm curious how you feel about, obviously, you probably still believe in having laws and punishments even while not believing in free will.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the purge. I think it's interesting. I think human society and ethics and laws will have to evolve as we get a deeper and deeper understanding of ourselves and, you know, the human mind and all sorts of stuff. But it's not unparalleled in human history. A lot of similar arguments were made when people used science to challenge sort of like theological explanations for the origin of the universe. People were worried, well, if you challenge people's belief in God, then nobody will think that murder is bad, right? And then everybody would just go out and start killing all the time. And I think that's silly. We know that we can build a society of laws and values that are not rooted in some creator and some theological mystery, that there's a practical way to construct values in society that let it work and function. And so that was a big step forward, I think. And it shows that, you know, our society can be constructed even as the foundational questions and the ideas which some people think undergird it are shifted. We can still build a useful functioning society, but it'll be a challenge. Like if somehow we get a complete understanding of the physical nature of the universe and show conclusively that people are not actually making choices, then, you know, we have to do some careful thinking about how to organize our society, how to punish people, what values to uphold. But there's some really fun and interesting, I think, philosophical experiments about whether people can be morally held to account even if they don't have free will. And I think that's pretty interesting. Have you read those experiments, like the Frankfurt ideas?
I don't think so.
Well, there's this whole set of thought experiments where people say, what if you took somebody's brain and you inserted into their brain a computer, and the computer would monitor their actions, and anytime their brain would make a decision that you don't agree with, it would, you know, influence the brain. It would send zaps, whatever, to change their decision. But if that person was going to make the decision you agreed with, then it wouldn't interfere. So for example, say you met somebody who was going to vote for Clinton and you wanted them to vote for Trump. So you insert a little thing into their brain. And when they go in the voting booth, if you see that they're going to vote for Clinton, you know, the computer makes a decision and zaps their brain to make them vote for Trump. And if they were just going to anyway vote for Trump, then you just leave it alone. So what happens then if that person votes for Trump? Are they morally responsible for their vote because they made the decision? But they didn't really have a freedom, right? They were going to end up voting for Trump either way. The computer was going to intervene if they didn't. And so they're sort of like morally responsible for their vote because they made that decision, even though it was, you know, determined from the beginning that they were going to end up voting for Trump. And so you can imagine these fun situations where people are morally responsible for their choices, even if they couldn't actually influence the outcome.
Yeah, to me, it almost seems like some of our ideas around this are overly complicated, and may in the future we'll look back and be like, we were asking such weird questions, because some of these questions just don't make sense if you do view the world as an unfolding a reaction. You know, it's some of these questions just seem kind of extraneous to me, maybe because I've I've lived so long with the idea that free will is unlikely. It almost seems like we tend to overcomplicate it. You can imagine flashing forward like 100 years and having the way people talk about things will be completely different than how we talk about them now. We get so in the weeds of these things that we instinctually believe are true, but may not be.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I love seeing how questions evolve through time, right? People are asking one question, then later realize, oh, that was totally the wrong question. We should have been asking this other question. Or then you make some big discovery and you realize the universe is different from the way you imagined it. And that brings up all totally new questions. You know, I would love to read like a children's book about science from the year 3000. Just to get like a basic sense for like, what are the questions are they asking? What are they wondering about? Could I even understand the questions right. they're asking in 100 to 500, 1,000 years?
Yeah, I'm reading this interesting book now. It's called A Philosophy in a New Key, or Philosophy in a New Key. It's from the 50s or 60s, I think. But it talks about, we are restrained by the questions that we ask, by how we frame the questions. And a lot of times philosophical shifts are taking the form of like, looking at the world in such a new way that the questions they ask spark whole new lines of thought, you know, and that's mm-hmm. why things can happen so rapidly, because we just start looking at them in a completely different way. So getting to the other side of things, maybe the positive aspects of not believing in free will, there was a 2017 study that showed that people who read content that was critical of free will ideas were then shown to be less punitive when asked to mete out rewards for people's transgressions. Actually, and interestingly, that study, it was apparently only the women that had an effect on, which that's a whole other topic. But so in other words, it seemed that thinking about how humans are such a product of the forces around them makes people less judgmental. And I feel that's true for me. And I'm curious if you can relate to that, because I feel like in my life, these ideas make me see the world as much more holistic, everything being connected. And that leads to me being less judgmental of people. I'm curious if you can relate to that.
Absolutely. And I think we've seen a lot of that this past year, where somebody, for example, has been shot by police. And then how you frame that person's life story really affects how people view them and whether they were like at fault for that. Is this somebody who's had a difficult life and has a lot of things go against them in life? Or is this, you know, somebody who's trying to take advantage of the system? And so I think putting people in context definitely changes how you feel about them and the judgments you make about them. I think it's really interesting to imagine, though, like making judgments about people when you feel like they can't make judgments. Like this whole question about like moral responsibility in the case of free will. Like, if you don't believe in free will, then why are we worried about making decisions about people? Because we're not making decisions if there isn't any free will, right? The whole thing is sort of moot. It makes us sort of like observers in the world. We're just sort of like watching the world unfold, as you say, and we are part of that story. But you know, if you don't believe that free will is a thing, then you shouldn't worry so much about how to handle it, how you are going to decide how to respond to your lack of free will, because there is no decision in that case.
I really like that biblical quote. I don't think it was actually in the Bible, actually, but there, but for the grace of God go I, because I think that sums up to me. I really do believe, as someone who finds the idea of free will very unlikely, I really do believe if I was in another person's shoes fully, you know, like if I had their upbringing, their experience, their genetics, the random, you know, whatever that they're going through, I would truly be that person. And that idea, that compassion comes directly from the idea that I think free will is very unlikely mm-hmm. and that we are just the product of everything that has come before.
Yeah, I agree.
I also think, you know, relatedly to that, I think it also leads to a lack of pride in accomplishments, which I think some people might view as a negative. Some of my wife has sometimes scoffed at me, you know, when we talk about me being proud of something I've done, and I'm like, I'm not really proud. I don't pretend I'm not human. I am proud of some things. I have the feeling sometimes, but mm-hmm. mostly I think those kind of things don't really resonate with me, because I do feel that I am a product of everything that's come before me. So I'm curious if that, does that affect your life? Do you feel like it's affected your sense of pride and accomplishments too, and your ability to take pleasure in such things?
I do sometimes feel like my life now is at the mercy of decisions that I made 20 years ago. And boy, those decisions mystify me. Like, my kids ask me, like, well, why did you become a physicist? And you know, I try to explain, but I don't even really understand the choices I made. And the story I have about the choices I made doesn't hold up to even like the slightest scrutiny. You know, for example, they asked me like, why did you become a physicist? And the story I have in my mind is that I just started taking physics because it seemed like the hardest class. And I figured like, well, I'll just try the hardest thing and see how that goes. And then I just sort of like kept doing it and dot, 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 here I am, a professor of physics. And that doesn't really make any sense. And either that means that either I made those choices really kind of stupidly, or there was something else going on that I wasn't really aware of, which I think is more likely. You know, there was some satisfaction I found in succeeding at those classes, or I was enjoying it in some way I couldn't really put my finger on, or that didn't get incorporated into my narrative. And I think to me that reveals a lot about how I think choices and free will work, is that it's mostly we are building stories about what just happened, trying to integrate them together into an understanding of our experience. There's no actual like moment of choice. It's just like a, hey, this just happened and here's how I'm going to try to understand it. And that just happened and here's how I'm going to try to understand it. And if you don't spend a lot of time on introspection, then you don't really have a sense for how things happened and whether they made any sense. And sometimes they just don't. And so, yeah, I think about like my accomplishments in life and my failures in life, and I wonder like, could things have gone differently? But I don't really have access to the person who made those decisions. I can't like call up 20-year-old me and say, what are you doing? Why aren't you taking more art classes? Or why aren't you going to more parties? Or why are you doing so much homework all the time, you big nerd? I wish I could talk to that person, but I wonder if I would even really recognize them or know them.
Well, yeah, to your point, I mean, even sometimes I don't even understand the decisions I made an hour ago. I mean, because exactly. I really feel that in my life, you know, like we want to perceive ourselves as these coherent beings. But mm-hmm. I mean, I really feel the chaos and the in my life personally. And I think, thinking about these ideas maybe opens you up more to the kind of randomness in your own mind and life. But I definitely relate to that. You open up an interesting line of discussion there, because there is a lot of research around our narrative building, our confabulation, really about what our own drives and desires are. Like there were really interesting brain studies by Gazzanica involving people who had their left and right brains split. The experiments involved people who whose one part of their brain saw something on one side of their vision, but the other side of the brain wasn't conscious of it. And what would happen was people would confabulate, would make up stories, even though part of their brain knew what they had seen, but the other part of their brain was creating a narrative for why they said what they said without being consciously aware of what they said. And these kinds of experiments, there's other experiments like that too, but the gist of it was what we have these confabulatory centers in our brain, and Gazzanica, you know, called this part of the brain that he thought did this, he called it the interpreter, which was a place where we would interpret things that happened to us or things that, you know, things that we did and put them into a narrative of what made sense for us. Like, but in a post hoc way, like after the fact, we would create these narratives. And I think that is a big part of being human. We put all these things that are going on into this narrative structure, and that creating stories is a big part of being human. And I think it's at a more core level than I think people realize. It's from an out, you know, a second to second level of like, how can I put this into a framework that makes sense, even if the things that led to me doing that were completely beyond my control.
Absolutely. And, you know, we are building these stories and telling these stories to ourselves and believing them, right? And I think you're totally right. I think storytelling and building narratives is really the foundation of human thought and consciousness. It's like the basis element. Mm-hmm. You can imagine, like, how would you want an intelligent creature to evolve? Well, it should learn rules about the universe it finds itself in and then use those rules to try to manipulate its environment and improve its chances of success. And it will do that best if it can find patterns and tell little stories, you know, stories about how to find food in the winter or how to hunt game or whatever. These things, these stories we tell are really just like little proto-scientific explanations of how to describe what we've experienced and how to predict the future. And that's, I think, why science is so focused on like cause and effect. You know, that's a story you're telling about something that occurred and then happened. So I think it's absolutely foundational. I think storytelling is the way we think. I don't know if you have kids, but I see this in my kids also. I say like, well, why did you just do that? It's like, I don't know. I'm like, what do you mean you don't know? And, you know, they haven't developed sometimes this like self-knowledge, or at least this self-storytelling, where they can say, they can access that and be like, well, I think I wanted the cookie, and so I took the cookie.
My sister made me do
like,
it.
I don't know.
Yeah. They haven't, yeah, they got to create the blame, you know?
Yeah, it's fascinating to see that develop.
So I want to get back to some of the anxieties and fears people have, because I thought this would be beneficial to people listening to this that are kind of threatened by these ideas. And I'm going to go through a few of these ideas and why they don't actually bug me. And I'll kind of spark your feedback as I go.
Sure.
Let's look at the first one I have here. Let's assume for a moment that we don't have free will. It's hard to imagine how having free will would look much different than what we currently have. So even if we don't have free will, we are still obviously very complex entities that can process a lot of information. And for all intents and purposes, we make choices, even if those choices may be the result of all sorts of complex processing and dynamics beyond our control. That's kind of summarizing one reason why these ideas are not that threatening to me, because on a very human level, which is all we have access to, a human level, that we still have these choices for all intents and purposes.
I suppose so. I mean, you could also imagine asking like a Tesla, why did you choose to change lanes? Well, it certainly made a choice. It had some data. It had an algorithm. It made a choice. I don't know if you could then hold the Tesla responsible for its choice and make it feel like to blame for changing lanes or not changing lanes or not stopping when it hit a pedestrian. So I think that, you know, you can have systems that make choices, even if they have no like really opportunity to make other choices, they still are making choices. Maybe that makes people feel like they have some influence, but I'm not sure that, you know, making choices that necessarily means you have any sort of options.
So an outcome of that kind of thinking is, it's hard for me to imagine how, if we had free will, like say we learned we definitely had free will that transcended physical laws, it's hard for me to imagine how much different it would be. Like it's almost like it's such a weird question to ask. It's hard to even imagine how that would even manifest.
Well, I guess you could do the thought experiment of fast forwarding 1,000 years into the future and imagining that science has now been able to model the human brain at the truly microscopic level and understand how it works. If you are not making choices, if there's no free will, then in theory, your brain could be predictable, right? If we manage to overcome the barriers of chaos theory just by sheer power of quantum computing or something crazy, then it's possible that we could predict your choices. We could scan you and mimic you and predict exactly what you would do in various circumstances. And so I guess that would be a difference, right? It'd be sort of shocking to see yourself, all of your choices predicted.
Right. And I guess it just seems so distant a concept. And I guess for people that are bugged by these ideas, I guess to me, the point is like, well, can you even, from a day-to-day perspective, can you even imagine it being much different whether we had free will or didn't, you know? Because it seems like even with free, say you had free will, it would seem like you would still be impacted by the past and by your experience. Like you wouldn't just be this free-floating, like godlike entity able to choose, you know, of your own accord. It seems like it's such a weird thing to dive into, because it seems like, well, what would the difference really be like for all intents and purposes, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's also important to separate two connected concepts, free will and consciousness. Whether or not you have free will, you do still have a first person subjective experience. You are living your life. You're inside your mind,
which is amazing.
Which is amazing and totally not understood. And like, you know, I think an even harder and deeper problem in philosophy and science. And I don't even know if it is a scientific question, because can you even probe it? Because you can't ever step out of your subjective experience. But, you know, if you are shown to not have free will, it doesn't strip away your conscious experience. You can be conscious without free will. So you are still having that pizza or driving that Tesla or, you know, arguing with your wife or whatever. That doesn't change your life. It doesn't like disappear in a puff. Now you are like the mental equivalent of a Tesla, which doesn't have a first person experience. So it doesn't strip away that, I think, most essential part of being alive.
That's what it gets down to me too. It's, even if these ideas are theoretically anxiety producing, they just seem so distant to me because at a very human level, I, like you said, consciousness experience is amazing. Even if we can debate what the causes of our choices are, we still have, we still experience the results of all of the things that we call choices, and we still live this life. This is maybe a good segue into there's kind of that fatalistic, nihilistic response to some of these ideas. And I would say that it's not entirely related to the idea of free will, because there's nothing stopping us from being fatalistic and existentially depressed, even if we were 100% sure we had free will. So we can imagine someone proving to us beyond a shadow of a doubt that our brains are special, that they're operating in some magical way that allows us to transcend physical laws. And even with that knowledge, we could still easily find existence completely meaningless, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like we desire something special to be granted to us. And we think that will give us the ability to find meaning in our life. But I would argue it's a separate topic, because it's almost just pushing the question farther away. Because, you can imagine being an entity with completely free will and still be like, well, there's still no meaning in the world. What is the point of all this?
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to imagine what that's like.
There's other kind of questions like that I feel are kind of similar. Like the idea of God or a higher power is also just kind of pushing the question one step forward too. It's like, well, there's a God or a higher power, right? I don't have to think about the idea that the universe may be meaningless. But in a sense, you could imagine believing that there is a higher power that created us and still wonder, well, what is the point of that entity existing? I haven't really solved the underlying concept of what is meaningful or what's not meaningful, or, I could have been created by a God and all of this could still be meaningless. So I don't know. Some of these questions just seem like we want some concept of our specialness is really what we want. We want to be granted some special privilege, and that will alleviate some of our existential angst, it feels like.
And frankly, I've never really understood how people think about free will if they also believe in an all-powerful God who's essentially directing everything. Like, how can you still be morally responsible for your choices if there's an all-powerful being that set everything in motion and has some grand plan? I don't really understand.
Right. That's a tough paradox for a lot of religions, I feel like. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Christianity kind of addresses that a bit, where they're like, it's the paradox of God having a plan and us having free will, but it's not really an answer. They just acknowledge that it's a magical paradox or something.
Yeah. There are a lot of these questions that you're just sort of like not allowed to ask because the answer is beyond human understanding. And I think that's something wonderful about science. It's the sort of the ego to imagine that maybe we could understand the universe. Maybe we could build a model in our heads of how things are working out there and use it to make progress and reveal more truths. And so that's something to me that's very attractive about science.
And I've also had people that respond when I talk about these ideas, they respond in ways that are kind of like belittling the idea that I could have ethics or believe that things are right or wrong, or why I would even care if I didn't believe in free will, mm-hmm. And I think that, that's getting back to these fatalistic ideas of, what's the point of doing anything if I don't have free will. But I would argue, we still have these drives, and I can still, if there's anything I'm sure of, it's like the Descartes idea of I think, therefore I am. I do exist, and I believe other people exist, and I believe suffering exists, and I could use these kinds of ideas to give up. But at the end of the day, we obviously do have the power to change things, even if we can debate what that actually means at the core of it. But obviously I can pick up a pencil right now. I can try to relieve someone's suffering right now, even if I believe that those are all the outcome of previous things. Yeah. So I think, but I feel like some people use these ideas to be like, well, what's the point? Like, I might as well do horrible things or do whatever I feel like. But to me, it's, some of the core aspects of life are, I believe suffering is bad, and I believe suffering exists, and I believe in relieving suffering. Mm-hmm. And I know that is in my power to do that, even if I don't believe in free will.
Yeah. And you could ask those folks like, well, why aren't you doing bad things right now? What's preventing you from doing that? It's the choices you're making and your empathy and your concern for other folks. It's not like we are purely calculating robots all the time. Even if you believe that everybody out there is just a machine following some deterministic laws, you still care about people, right? It's not like I am totally driven scientifically to make every decision. Not like every choice I make is perfectly rational. If I was perfectly rational, I would have doubts about whether or not anyone else around me was even conscious, right? I could be a solipsist and say, I am the only being in the universe and everybody else is a zombie. And so I might as well just go out and take whatever I want. That would be a rational conclusion, but not something I do because I feel for people. I have empathy. I feel their experience in their bodies reflected in my own mind. And that's not rational. It's not scientific, but it's the way I live. And so I think that's an artificial argument people make. It's just like when people say, if there's no God, then anybody would go out there and murder as much as they want. And we're like, well, I'm currently murdering exactly as much as I want, which is zero, right? And it's not because there's a God or not a God. It's just, I don't want to murder anybody.
And to that point, it's, there's nothing, even believing in free will, like these don't save you from antisocial ideas. You could be entirely believing in free will and still be a complete monster. Like, yeah. I feel like these ideas get kind of conflated because they all do kind of relate to our fears of meaninglessness and our fears of isolation and all of these existential fears. But to me, there's quite a variety of separate topics there. And I will, I'll use this as an opportunity to plug like one of the most meaningful books I've ever read. Mm-hmm. Probably I would call it the most important book I've ever read. It's called Existential Psychotherapy by Irvin Yalom. Mm. And it's about all these existential fears that we all have and how, existential psychology is about how these basic fears that we all have as humans, even as just entities existing in the world, lead to various anxieties and fears and sufferings. And I just recommend it greatly. I've bought it for so many people I know. So if anyone's interested in that kind of stuff, it's a great book.
It sounds cool. I'll dig into it.
Oh yeah. I really recommend it. I've spent several hundred dollars buying it for people I've known. So I definitely recommend it. So getting to the end of this, we talked a little bit about how it increases our compassion and empathy for people, but on a broader sense, I feel like these kind of beliefs, thinking about these things, makes me feel more connected to things. Almost, you could call it from a spiritual sense too. As opposed to feeling like I'm separate from things, I feel like I am part of things in a very real sense. And I'm curious if you can relate to that in your life.
Yeah, once you start digging into this question of like cause and effect and how things turn from one event to another, you realize that there are a lot of artificial distinctions that we're inserting into these questions based just on our experience, like the distinction between my body and the rest of the universe, right? Like, where does my body end? Is it the outermost set of particles and electrons? But there's like a frothing mess of particles there at the interface, And so like the definition even just of like, what is me? Who am I? Sort of from a physical universe point of view, isn't really clear. It's totally arbitrary. Is it my brain? Is it my body? Is it some volume around my body? And so it's from that point of view, it becomes very clear that we are just part of this huge frothing mass of particles that are swooshing in and out of existence. And that we've sort of like drawn a dotted line around some of them, but that dotted line is not even very well defined. And so, yeah, absolutely. We are all just part of this big ocean of particles smashing into each other constantly.
When I think about what I am, this concept of I, whatever I am, my consciousness is, it's some mysterious force, some force of the universe that has come to be, that is beyond my understanding, beyond my control, beyond anyone's mm-hmm. understanding right now. And, when you think about what that force is, those things that have led to us having this experience, is that what God is? Is that what a higher power is? Something that is beyond our control that has led to us having this experience? I think a lot of times people have kind of nihilistic views of these thoughts. But to me, it opens up a whole new realm of theoretically a realm of, spiritual inquiry, too.
Absolutely. And that's one reason, for example, why I'm excited to meet intelligent aliens and ask them if they have similar questions. You can imagine different biological constructions might lead to very different relationships with the physical universe. For example, we tend to think of ourselves as individuals, like I am one and you are one. And that probably relates to the whole idea of like integers, mathematical numbers between the real numbers that are like these whole units. because we think of ourselves as individuals. You can imagine another kind of species where like the boundaries between individuals are sort of fuzzy. There may be more blobs and they exchange bits more easily and they're just sort of like part of a larger mass, and maybe they don't think of themselves as individuals and don't even have the concept of integers. And you know, it'd be fascinating to see the universe from a totally different perspective biologically and see if that influences how you see the sort of foundational physical concepts. But of course, we can't step out of this human experience until we meet intelligent aliens and get to talk to them about science.
And one thing I want to get back to, I mentioned it earlier, I might as well throw it in here, that the idea that if we were completely responsible, like say we had complete free will somehow, there's theoretically a lot of anxiety there too, because a lot of anxiety people have can be centered around like fear of our own freedom, fear of making the wrong decision when we have so much choice, fear that we've failed ourselves, fear that we've done so many things wrong. And there's some trauma models of psychosis and schizophrenia, especially more catatonic aspects of it, that center around fears of people affecting the world, fears of being responsible, and fear of making the wrong movement. These kind of theories of these experiences center around fears of impacting the world, you know. So I would argue there's just as much to be scared of on the opposite end of the spectrum in that regard of like, there can be a lot of anxiety about being completely in control, you know, and it's not clearly that the only anxiety is around us being basically objects, you know. On the other end of the spectrum, we have this fear of freedom, which can be intimidating.
Yeah, and choices don't always make people happy, right? They're those fun experiments where they give people an option between like a cookie and a brownie, and they have another group where they just give them a cookie, and the folks that just got a cookie and didn't get a choice tend to be happier with their cookie than the ones that chose a cookie, and they're like, maybe I should have had the brownie. And so choice doesn't always make people happy. And I think we also see that, you know, politically in some people's preference for like, you know, autocrats. Mm-hmm. They want somebody, a strong leader in charge, to make these choices for them. They don't want to feel like they're responsible for the outcome of their lives. They want somebody up there with a guiding hand to be in charge and to release them from the responsibility of choice.
Right. And they're threatened by ideas in the sense that all of these different philosophies could be true. So they want someone to just like nail it down and be like, here's what to believe. Mm-hmm. You know? And yeah. I think that is a big part of things. Yeah. So, finally, I want to say, you know, if you're listening to this and these kind of ideas do bug you, at the end of the day, no one's going to prove this anytime soon. So it shouldn't weigh on you too much, because who knows when we'll ever solve it. We'll probably destroy ourselves as a species before we ever completely prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that you don't have free will. So I just wanted to end on that, because
that's your attempt to be hopeful.
Yeah, that's my tip. Life tip. Yeah, life tip.
Don't worry.
go about your life is what I'm saying.
We'll probably kill ourselves before we prove that you're a robot.
Yeah, and there's some positivity in that. Is there anything you feel that we've missed along the way?
No, I think this is a lot of fun. There's so many other little alleys you could dig into and explore for, you know, years and years and years. And I think this is why this has been a topic people have been talking about literally for millennia. And I think it'll continue to be a question we ask for quite a while. But I think it's also exciting, sort of the exponential rate of progress in science and in understanding means that potentially in 5, 10, 50 years, we could learn something about the brain or the nature of reality, which does fundamentally alter this conversation and the way we view these questions. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, and I'll say to the point of people talking about it, you know, since the dawn of modern intellect, there were fatalists, you know, like a couple thousand years ago in Greece, when they were doing their philosophical discussions, when people were saying, well, might as well not do anything at all if there's no free will, you know. So this has been a topic of discussion for thousands of years. Yeah. So thanks a lot for coming on, Daniel.
Thanks a lot for having me on. Really fun to talk about this stuff.
One area in this interview we didn't get much into was the idea that a disbelief in free will makes people less moral, makes them lazier in a fatalistic, what's it matter way. There are some psych studies around this topic that I should have found more time to work in. If you'd like to learn more about these, I recommend finding the blog post for this episode at my readingpokertells.video site and looking at the resources I have there. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can follow Daniel Whiteson on Twitter at Daniel Whiteson. And just a reminder about his physics book, We Have No Idea. If you're interested in physics, I recommend it. And you can follow me on Twitter at @apokerplayer. If you like this podcast, please give it a rating or review on iTunes or on the platform you listen on. That's the most appreciated way that you can express your appreciation. Thanks for listening. You really think you're in control?